afternoon, everyone. I'm Dr. Emma Wharton, and I'd like to warmly welcome you all to today's Talk BD event hosted by Crest BD. I'm really excited to introduce today's topic, the role of food and nutrition in mental health. You've probably seen or read about how our mood and diet are related, but it can be sometimes really difficult to sort out research from opinion, especially when we're getting inundated all the time with articles about various new diets or supplements. This is a really hot topic every year in our Crest BD Reddit Ask Me Anything events, so we're really privileged to hear today from Professor Felice Jacka, who is the director of the Food and Mood Centre based at Deakin University, Australia. We're also joined by Victoria Maxwell, one of the original Crest BD members, who was recently presented with the Morgan Shu Award for Public Advocacy and Service at the International Society for Bipolar Disorders Conference. And we're always very lucky to have her here to speak about her own lived experience and tips for staying well. Before I go into asking the panelists to introduce themselves, I'd like to welcome all new and returning guests and tell you a little bit more about this event. So this is the 23rd Talk BD event, and the Talk BD webinar series is hosted by Crest BD, a collaborative research network dedicated to improving and sharing knowledge about bipolar disorder. And by collaborative, I mean that academics, clinicians, and people with lived experience and their families work hand in hand to research ways to live well with bipolar disorder and share the results of our work back with the community. I would like to note that although there'll be two Australian accents on the line today, Crest BD is actually based in Canada, although we are really fortunate to extend our reach internationally with online events and resources like today's session. So I'll get us started with some quick introductions. I am a researcher at the University of British Columbia, and I've been working with Crest BD ever since my PhD. Currently, we're working on developing and evaluating a new self-management app to help people with bipolar disorder optimize their quality of life. But I will put a pin in that for now and tell you a little bit more about that study at the end of today's session. Here at Crest BD, we try to practice what we preach about work-life balance. So I'll also ask our guests to share something non-work related about themselves. For me, when I'm not working, I'm generally running or hiking and exploring beautiful British Columbia when it's not raining on another January day like today. I'm a member of a couple of social groups that motivate themselves to go running by getting various treat foods along the way, and I'm not sure how that's going to pan out in light of today's topic. I'll now pass the mic to Felice to introduce herself. So we'd really love to hear about where you work, as well as one non-work thing you enjoy in your downtime.
Thanks so much, Emma, and it's great to be here today. My name's Felice Jacka. I'm director of the Food and Mood Centre at Deakin University, and we're really recognised internationally for leading this field of nutritional psychiatry research. I'm also founder and president of the International Society for Nutritional Psychiatry Research. And I was previous president of the Alliance for the Prevention of Mental Disorders in Australia. And I think that informs a lot of my my work is, you know, this understanding that there are things that we can do potentially to prevent mental illness developing in the first place, as well as treating it when it does arise. I love food, that probably doesn't surprise anyone. and I've got a new adopted grandchild in my life, and that's bringing a lot of joy as well. So I love living near the coast, the beach, and I'm often to be found outside and walking on the beach or in the rainforests, which are near where I live.
Thank you so much, Felice. Congratulations on your expanding family, and I definitely miss the Australian beaches. Victoria, I'd like to invite you to introduce yourself.
Thanks, Emma. Nice to see you, Felice. My name is Victoria Maxwell, for those of you who have been joining us before on these webinars. And I live with bipolar disorder, anxiety, and psychosis. And as Emma said, I've been with CRESBD for, since its inception, really, I guess. And I'm a keynote speaker and educator and performer about my own lived experience in recovery. Some on sort of my personal life, one of the things that I've taken up recently is gardening, which I know probably a lot of you or some of you may already be doing and have done for a long time. It's really new to me. So I've got my little tomato plants. I planted all these strawberry plants and the strawberry plants are coming along very well. So I'm very happy about that. So we'll see how many actually come through and how many get eaten by deers, because that's the biggest problem.
That is a hazard I hadn't normally considered when gardening. We also have our behind the scenes helpers, Caden and Bryn, assisting with the Zoom chat and our Facebook and YouTube pages. A little bit of housekeeping before we kick off. We have people joining us live via Zoom and YouTube. We also have people submit questions before the event. So if you have questions, please put them into the Q&A box or into the CRESBD Facebook page, and we will spend about the first half an hour having Felice and Victoria talk a little bit about food and mood, and then we'll move on to audience Q&A. So for now, I'll hand the mic over to our panelists.
Terrific. Well, it's great to be here. Would you like me to start by explaining what nutritional psychiatry actually is and how it sort of came about? So we're concerned with understanding through very rigorous science how what we eat influences our mental and brain health. When I came into psychiatry research, which was quite accidental, it was about 15 years ago, and it was, you know, my second career. And I was very interested to realise that in psychiatry, unlike the rest of medicine and, you know, cardiovascular disease, cancer, etc., there was really very little evidence or knowledge or thought about how what we eat might influence our mental and brain health. And that, I think, is because psychiatry has for a very long time not really concerned itself with anything that happens below the neck. And, you know, this thinking that it's all about what happens in the brain, it's all about neurons and neurotransmitters and you know, our thoughts. But at around the time I came into this area of research, there was a new field burgeoning, and it was a bit of a mouthful. It's called nutrition, it's called psychoneuroimmunology. But it basically recognized the links between the immune system and our mental and brain health, and these bi-directional links, and how, you know, the immune system and the brain are very tightly linked. And it started to highlight that, you know, maybe we shouldn't just be thinking about the head, but, you know, us as a fully integrated system. And of course, diet is a really important influencer of immune function, and we already knew that. And at around that time too, there were a lot of very, very interesting studies coming out of the US in the field of neuroscience. There was an increasing recognition that there was a key region of the brain called the hippocampus that is very much a target of antidepressant medications. It's very much involved in learning and memory, but also in our mental health. And it's the one area of the brain that's plastic. It grows and shrinks in response to what's happening to us and within us. And they were showing in rodents that you could influence the size and the function of the hippocampus by changing dietary factors. So there was this emerging area, different strands of research that suggested that we really should be thinking about food and what we eat as a potential influencer of mental health. And, you know, in the broader context, we know that mental disorders account for a massively large burden of disability right around the world. And depression is the sort of the biggest piece of that pie. So it affects many, many people, of course, and it's a difficult one to treat. We know that psychotherapy, antidepressants can often be helpful for people, but there's a very large chunk of people who either don't respond at all or don't fully respond. So there's a huge unmet need. But when we also think about mental disorders, so many of the risk factors have traditionally been understood to be not very amenable to change. So things like our genetics and our early life experiences, poverty, stress, all of these sorts of things, they're difficult to modify. So understanding what things we might be able to change to think about prevention as well as treatment is very important. And of course, diet really falls into that. And there were a lot of new experiments and research going on looking at physical activity and how that might both prevent and help treat depression. And so that sort of came alongside the diet, but there really wasn't much in the area of diet. And of course, the even bigger context is our industrialized food system, which has completely changed the way people eat right across the world, such that poor diet is now the leading cause of death and early death across the world. The industrialized food system, its impact on human health and the environment, is getting up to be as equivalent to the whole GDP of China every year. But of course, there's very little food policy to try and address this food environment that's meaning that so many of us are moving towards the consumption of these ultra processed foods, foods that are really designed to interact with the reward systems of our brain and, you know, what make us want more. And they're everywhere, everywhere we go, filling up the car with petrol, what have you, and very heavily marketed. And so people's diets have really shifted a lot. And this isn't just for people who, you know, have lack of access to income or education or whatever. This is everyone. So there were all these macro factors that made me think, well, this is really important to look at. How might these two leading causes of illness and death intersect? Can we modify diet to prevent mental disorders? So I undertook my PhD. Everyone thought I was a bit, you know, misled, or they were very skeptical, put it that way. But my PhD was the first to look at the link between the quality of people's diets and whether or not they had a clinical depressive and anxiety disorder. And because it was, and of course, taking into account all those other things that we need to consider, like income and education and body weight and other health behaviours, and it showed that there was a very clear link. And this was considered so novel that it was actually published on the front cover of the American Journal of Psychiatry, which was a very big deal. And around the same time, there were two other very important studies published from the UK and Spain showing very similar things, looking prospectively. This didn't seem to be explained by people eating differently because of their mental health, which is, of course, something that does happen. And as I said, it wasn't explained by those other sorts of factors that we need to consider. So from there, we started to develop this very large evidence base from what's called the observational literature. So this is where you're not doing an experiment, but you're just collecting data from large groups of people and you're using statistics to actually look at how things relate. And from that very large population level data, we now have from right across the world, across, you know, whether it's Japan or Norway or China or what have you, a very consistent evidence base showing that if people who have healthier diets have about a 30% risk reduction for depressive illness. And then, of course, we move into randomized controlled trials, and I could talk a bit more about that in a moment, but showing that if you take people who even have very severe clinical depression and help them to improve their diet, it has a massive impact on their depressive symptoms, their functioning, and that you can do this cheaply, so affordably and easily, with the right information and the right tools. So this is where nutritional psychiatry fits, our food and mood centre. We're running many, many, many studies, more than 20 at the moment. We cover the whole gamut from really basic science, trying to understand how things work, you know, looking at the gut microbiota and things like that, right the way through to these big population health studies to understand how we might do this in clinical practice. And we've just submitted and we'll soon publish the first guidelines on lifestyle psychiatry.
Oh, fantastic. Now, before you dive into some of that research in more detail, I'll just invite Victoria. I don't know, how much have you heard about nutritional psychiatry and how does that influence what you practice?
I mean, I'm not as familiar with it. I did talk to someone about orthomolecular psychiatry, but I don't know the connection between that and what you're doing. But what I do know from my own experience is that I recently probably went through a really, really severe bout of anxiety and depression. And I was working with a new psychiatrist, and I was so impressed with him, because the first thing, because I was doing all my regular wellness tools to try to move out of this or just, you know, help myself. And he said, you know, I had reached a biological barrier, which means it doesn't matter really how much I was doing. There's my chemistry, my system was physiologically out of whack. So he prescribed fish oil, some of the things I think you'll probably be talking about, sort of some things in my diet that I wasn't getting enough of. And it definitely started to support a lot of it was definitely one of the things that have helped my mood, and I've continued to do that. So those are things that I've see that have some similarity to what you're talking about, and they're relatively accessible. It's not a huge financial burden on me as well. So
Do you like me to respond to that, Emma?
Oh, I know you had some evidence that you wanted to talk about what's informing the guidelines and kind of some general rules that we might all benefit by adopting.
So firstly to say, and that before I came into this area and before we founded this field of nutritional psychiatry, there was a lot of very poor misinformation, and that really tarnished the idea of nutrition being important in mental health. And orthomolecular medicine was a big part of that, because there was a lot of misinformation promulgated with no evidence. And because of that, psychiatrists and scientists were very, very skeptical, and quite rightly so, because you need very good quality evidence to influence clinical guidelines and clinical practice. And so orthomolecular medicine didn't do us a lot of favours. Then there was a very big focus on fish oils and omega-3 and supplements. And of course, psychiatry loves this, because it's so much easier to give someone a pill rather than change someone's lifestyle behaviours. The evidence for nutritional supplements, which are very, very different to diet, they really are really not in the same, conceptually the same thing at all, is pretty limited. There is some evidence for some sorts of fish oil in some people under some circumstances as an adjunct to their normal treatment. Similarly, some forms of folate, but really it's only in the situation where someone is deficient that a supplement might be considered, and you have to be careful, because sometimes they can do more harm than good. We have two trials now where it's shown that multinutrient formulations, for example, have actually been worse than placebo. So I'm not a huge fan of supplements. I know that some people use them, but the evidence in nutritional psychiatry, which is very extensive now, is very much around dietary change. And that's pretty simply increasing the amount of plant foods, because this is has the phytonutrients and the fiber that the gut microbiota and the body needs. So this is your vegetables and fruits, but of course, different types of whole grains, you know, expanding from just wheat to think about oats and barley and rye and these other sorts of things. Legumes are very important, so chickpeas and lentils and navy beans, et cetera, nuts and seeds. Frozen vegetables, fantastic. Tinned fish, fantastic. Tinned and dried beans, very, very affordable, very easy to put together. This is where the evidence is, and we see this right across the world, that diets that are higher in these sorts of foods are associated with better, reduced depression risk, and ones that are higher in these junk and ultra-processed foods are associated with increased risk.
So I wouldn't mind just jumping in, because it's interesting, because what happened also during this time is I chose to eat more plant-based foods. So I'm moving away from, I don't know anything about the evidence around red meat, but really just eating way more beans, way more vegetables, sort of fiber, nuts, seeds, legumes, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and what I found over the last year, I guess, is that my mood is more stable and my anxiety has decreased. And if I do go into a dip, it's nowhere near as severe as it used to be. And I seem to return to baseline a lot more quickly.
And we think, you know, when you're talking about anxiety, because Victoria, that's what you were talking about. The gut-brain axis, I think people are very, they've heard this term because we've known about the gut-brain axis for a very, very long time. So this is that very strong pathway connected by the vagus nerve and all sorts of hormones and other signaling molecules. 90% of the signals go from the gut to the brain, but about 10% go from the brain to the gut. And you see that people who have irritable bowel syndrome, which is very common, also very commonly have anxiety and depressive symptoms, and vice versa, people with these sorts of symptoms will often have gut problems. And this is because of this gut-brain axis. More recently, we've understood that there are just, you know, thousands of microbes, millions, trillions that live on us and in us. They've co-evolved with us, and the ones in our gut, that's the largest sort of family of microbes. And they seem to play a very important role in all of these things that affect our mental and brain health. So the way our genes express and our immune system and our mitochondria and the way our neurotransmitters are produced, all of these things, the gut really has a very large part to play. And so when you're feeding your gut those sorts of things, Victoria, like the fiber and the more plant type foods that have all the phytonutrients and the fiber, you're feeding the gut bacteria that produce thousands of molecules that interact with all these systems in the brain. But because the gut, the stress response system is very much part of this gut-brain axis, it's helping with anxiety because it's helping that stress response. So you're absolutely on the right path. People don't need to be vegan or vegetarian. Moderate amounts of, you know, as long as it's not ham and bacon and very processed meats, seems to be associated, particularly for women, with good mental health. Too much is not good. Too little seems to be a problem for women. We don't know yet whether that's true in men, though. So it's, and we don't know if it's a causal relationship either. So that's just a cautionary tale. But you don't need to go to a very extreme diet, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Now, I'll just jump in, Felice, and say with what you've mentioned about causal relationships, we don't necessarily have a clinical or academic audience on the line today. Do you mind explaining what that term means? Yeah.
So I think a lot of people will have heard that idea that correlation doesn't equal causation. So even though we can see that the quality of someone's diet is linked to their mental health, and we do as much as we can to take into account other things that could explain that link, without doing an experiment, you can't say that this is causal, that diet is causing mental health. So this is what we addressed in the SMILES trial. So the SMILES trial is very well known. It was the first randomized controlled trial to test that hypothesis that if you take someone who has got moderate to severe clinical depression, if you help them to improve their diet, does that improve their mood? And so people were randomly assigned to get either dietary support just from a clinical dietitian or social support, a befriending protocol, which we know is really helpful for people with depression, over a 3-month period. And the people in the dietary support group, well, they just got support to increase those sorts of foods that Victoria was talking about, healthy fats like olive oil and fats from avocado and nuts and things like that, and decrease their sweets and their fried foods and their, you know, less healthful foods. And we saw at the end of the study that there was a very large difference between the groups and the people who had the dietary support. Not only did they change their diet, but they experienced a very major benefit to their mental health, and approximately a third of them subsequently met criteria for full remission, which is very unusual in depression. Now, since then, several other trials have shown the same thing, and that it's effective, it's cost-effective, it's affordable. It doesn't need to be a special organic, you know, expensive diet. And now there are many other clinical trials underway that will start to address some of the gaps in knowledge. But by having a randomized controlled trial, what you're saying is, yes, we changed someone's diet, it's an experiment, and we showed that it improved their mood. So we call that a causal relationship.
Great, thank you so much. That sounds like a really powerful effect that you found in that trial. And I'm curious to hear from Victoria, because not every individual that we have online at this stage, we're not widely prescribing referrals to dietitians, and not everyone unfortunately lives in a country where they can have that kind of dietary support. What are some things that you found helpful, Victoria, in kind of adapting your lifestyle when you made those changes? It's not always easy to do.
No, it's not. Part of it was just giving myself a lot of wiggle room. So it wasn't that I had to, I noticed one of the comments about sort of saying, is it a vegetarian diet or whatever? And I've tried it before where, okay, I'm going to do vegetarian or vegan or something. And those extremes just don't work for me. And so it was sort of a gradual sort of like, you know, how they've celebrated sort of meatless Mondays or something like that. So I would just more often sort of just say in my head, okay, I'm just gonna do a month and see if I can have at least one or two vegetarian kind of meals each week and see how I like that. And then also, I mean, and cooking is something that I really enjoy as well. So I sort of let myself be on a bit of a treasure hunt around, let's see what kind of recipes I could have that didn't take a lot of time and that were really delicious as well, because, you know, I've been used to having like certain kind of like a lentil burger that fell apart and I didn't really like it very much. And I really like hamburgers. So really finding that kind of creative part as well. And then finding a real sort of finding out what my why was. And part of it was feeling better, like seeing, so just on a completely.
Unfortunately, I know Victoria is having some technical difficulties before the session, so hopefully we will.
It was also just my.
We've lost.
But
you.
Victoria's making some really great points about, and it's that why, because what we've been told forever. Oh, sorry, Victoria. Are you back?
Yes. Sorry. Can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah. Good.
Sorry.
That's all right. Well, I was just saying that what we've been told forever is that we should think about what we eat in relation to our body weight. It's all about body weight and calories and losing weight. Now, what we see in all the research that we do is that body weight just doesn't come into this equation. With the SMILES trial, the average body mass index of people in the trial was about 30. So it was on the border of overweight obesity. And that didn't change. This is not a weight loss diet. And I think when you take that pressure out of the picture, it gets rid of, you know, it stops being so stigmatizing. And the reality is that most people don't have all that much control over their body weight. Very difficult to change it once you have a larger body. It's not actually what this is about. This is about feeding your gut, feeding your brain, feeding your body, nourishing yourself. And when people realize that, and they realize that they can start to feel a lot better very, very quickly, that becomes the why. It really does reinforce that behavior, because you're not doing it for, you know, in case one day you might have a heart attack or something. You're doing it because it makes you feel good.
Yeah. And it's really, for me, can you still hear me all right? I know that I'm a little bit hiccuping from time to time. It really was about being kind to myself. And really a form of self-care. And it didn't mean that I stopped eating French fries or ice cream or whatever. It just meant that I brought in these other things. And the interesting thing is then I started to crave them more, actually. And I noticed if I had too much junk food in a row, I mean, like most of us, we don't feel that great, but I just was more and more motivated to do it. And, you know, and so sometimes I have to be mindful, because if I am in a depressive mode or anxious, you know, I need to be intentional. And I just have really changed my relationship with sort of my diet and my body to a place where it's about, like you said, feeling good and not motivated by losing weight or looking a certain way or anything, but just really, I don't know how to describe it, but coming home to myself, if that makes any sense at all.
Self-love, self-care.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, food is, it just nourishes us, doesn't it? And I mean, it underpins every process in our body and our brain. But it's much more than that. It's our connection to culture. It's connection to family. We prepare food for others that we love, and we do it for ourselves. You really do start to feel a huge benefit very quickly.
That's a really important message to hear, especially when we talk about food. There's so much unlearning in terms of messaging, societal messaging that we have to do in regards to the whys, why we're doing this, and so much important things that are attached to food beyond just what we weigh. And so that's been a really great introduction to the some of the science and cutting away some of the misinformation. I know that there's so much more to cover on this topic than we can wholly do within this brief little chat. What I wanted to do now is switch over to some audience Q&A, if that's all right with the two of you. Because we've got a really hot chat going on in terms of lots of questions, lots of enthusiasm on the topic. So my first question for the two of you comes from a guest, and they're asking about the keto diet. What does the evidence say on the keto diet versus depression and mania?
Unfortunately, this is something that's been very, very heavily promoted, particularly in North America, we find, by some practitioners, psychiatrists, psychologists, medical doctors. There's a couple of case reports published, but, you know, what people fail to understand, and this is a really important point, I think, because someone is a medical doctor does not mean that they have training in nutrition. We know that generally they have about 2 hours of training through their whole course. Nor does it mean that they understand research evidence or how to evaluate it. So there's been a couple of case studies of people who had a ketogenic diet, but when you switch to a ketogenic diet, you're potentially removing things like donuts and lots of sugar and sweetened beverages and things like that. What I would say is just very basically, there's no evidence at this stage that a ketogenic diet is helpful for any mental disorder. There's abundant evidence for that a diet that is high in fiber, which is what you get in plant food. So when you're eating vegetables, starchy vegetables, whole grain cereals, legumes and things, that's where you get the dietary fiber that feeds your gut bacteria. Abundant evidence that this is results in better mental health and better depression. No evidence for a ketogenic diet. And if you were to move to a very Atkins style, high saturated fat animal foods diet, that would be going 100% against every bit of evidence that we have, both established and emerging around the gut microbiota. That's not to say that ketosis itself might not be a strategy for particular very severe types of mental illnesses. And we're doing trying to pilot a healthful ketogenic diet, one that focuses on, you know, more plant foods and fish and monounsaturated fats in people with schizophrenia to see if it's helpful. But what we would say also is that it's a very difficult diet to maintain. It's very expensive. It's very bad for the planet if you choose the animal version. And every bit of evidence suggests that it's not good for us. And when people say carbs, they don't understand that carbs is not a thing, you know. You have donuts and sweets and ice creams and things like that. That's refined carbohydrates. But then you have all of those plant foods. They're complex carbohydrates. You can't lump them in together.
That's a really interesting perspective. You know, a lot of carbs get given lumped in with the bad name.
It makes us all just want to cry and tear our hair out.
Victoria, I don't know if you've ever tried this diet, but I know you maybe had something to comment on about how some of these really hard and fast rules that we have, that we can hear about what diet is best to follow, can be really difficult. I don't know whether you wanted to comment on any of that.
Oh, am I back?
You're back, yes.
I'm so sorry. I'm on, yes. I hopefully I'll have a better connection next time. You were asking if I'd ever sort of been on a sort of a similar kind of diet. Is that what you were wondering?
Either keto or anything that's, you know, got really hard and fast rules, and what you found the impact of that kind of restrictive intake to be.
Yeah. I mean, I've had an eating disorder for about 10 years, probably when I, in my 20s, probably late teens to mid 20s or so. And it really started with dieting. And then it became sort of very much about, you know, eliminating certain things, and just became very, very restrictive. And so I have not gone on to anything like Atkins or keto. But when it was that rigid, first of all, it wasn't nourishing at all, because it was all sort of based on guilt and punishment, really. And it wasn't something that was really supporting my mood, because I wasn't necessarily giving my body what it needed. It was on a, from a very intellectual point of view. So I can't speak to a keto. But what I have found with, in terms of very restrictive diet choices, is that it's really hard to maintain. And and so, you know, then I just would go into sort of binge eating disorder sort of mode. And so it just, you know, which became the opposite of what was healthy. So
diets just don't work. And I mean, we have abundant evidence of the fact that they do more harm than good, and increasing evidence that they may promote a energy conserving gut microbiota. So you can extract more energy from your food once you come off your diet. And of course, the whole point is that it's all then about guilt and punishment, exactly as you said, Victoria. And you know, orthorexia is an eating disorder that's now very, very common. And it's around this idea that you've got to be clean, and you've got to take this out of your diet and this, and you've got to stop dairy, and you've got to stop gluten, and all of these things with very little evidence base. And people get more and more anxious and more restrictive. So then they stop getting the nutrients that they need. And it's a disaster all round. So diets, just forget about them. Think about feeding your gut, feeding your brain, trying to reduce the bad stuff and increase the good stuff, doing it gradually, doing it in a way that's achievable for you. If you like hamburgers, just start adding half a tin of lentils in with the hamburgers and smishing them all up together. There's a great study in cancer underway at the moment. So I've had breast cancer twice, and it's in the cancer area that we're seeing very compelling human data coming out about the importance of the gut in our health outcomes and how people respond to immunotherapy and chemotherapy, etc. And the whole intervention for this breast cancer trial is just half a can of navy beans every day, in a salad or in your spag bowl or in your whatever. That's the whole thing, because increasing fiber, it just has such a powerful impact on the gut microbiota, because that's what the bugs eat. If you don't eat fiber and polyphenols, so they got nothing to eat. They can't do their thing.
I love that idea that we got a little, like I think one of your books, but we got a little terrarium of little, you know, friendly bugs.
There's a zoo stuff in my poo.
Yes. Well, and the funny thing is, just on a, if anyone wants it, I have fallen in love with chickpeas. I mean, I ate them before, but there's this whole chickpea mock chicken salad or whatever, and it's like, yeah, little pickles in it. Anyway, it's super delicious. And so every time I eat it, I always feel like, yay, beans.
Yeah. And I go, anything you're preparing, you go, could I add beans to that? And there's great pasta that you can get now that's made of legumes, you know, just like it's pasta, but it's made of legumes. So that's another really great way of sneaking more fiber into your diet.
I'm starting to think that part of our resource kit should have been the top three ways to eat beans from both of our panelists.
Because and then when you say legumes, it sounds much more sophisticated than beans.
So French lentils, very nice. So I'm getting the impression, you know, Felice, that you know, any kind of really rigid diet with hard and fast rules is not necessarily the way to go. And we did have a couple of questions come in about the opposite of keto, a plant-based diet. And we had a question about whether or not intermittent fasting has anything to any evidence. I don't know if you want to comment on those, or maybe just about pulling back more broadly, how we as consumers can sort through all of this information that's out there and figure out what we should do.
It's really tricky. I mean, as I said, it's hard for medical professionals to do, so it's even harder for the general public. And the industrialised food system has a very strong vested interest in making people very confused about what healthy is, because then they can sell their protein bars and their keto bars and their, you know, low-fat yogurts and blah, 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 with lots of sugar added. So people are really confused, and I totally get that. And this is why it's so important for us as the Food and Mood Centre that we creating resources and information for the public, and that's what our Food Mood Centre website can do. But it the vegan thing, I mean, I get veganism from an ethical and an environmental standpoint, but unless you're very, very careful and make sure that your diet is covering all the bases, then you can get into trouble. We have no idea whether red meat is causally related to mood. What we see is that there's this U-shaped relationship where people who eat less than or more than what's recommended tend to have worse mental health. But we don't know if that's causal. You can't run a trial and put some people on meat, some people on vegetarian diets, and follow them for 10 years and see what happens. I think any really strict diet has problems associated with it. It can tip into an eating disorder. It can promote guilt, worry, anxiety, self, you know, punishment, all of those things. And there's no evidence to suggest that you need to do that. All the evidence suggests that it's a diet that is just high in whole foods and low in processed foods that is the one to follow. So it can be, you can still have the things that you love. I mean, Friday night for me is ice cream night. You know, it's just about the balance. I mean, in Australia at the moment, adolescents eat an average of 7 serves of junk food a day. 7 serves, and this is just horrendous. And this is the same in the US, UK, whatever. These foods have crowded out the other foods. And what we also know from the research is that the both things are problematic. Too much of the bad food, regardless of how much good food you're having, is a problem. Not enough of the good food, even if you don't eat, you know, Macca's and Kentucky Fried, if you're not getting enough of that fiber and phytonutrients, then you're not going to be doing well either. So both things are a problem, and you just need to alter that balance.
Felice, I was wondering, does fruit come under that in terms of whole food, or is that considered sort of too high in natural sugar?
Look, I think there's been so much misinformation promoted about fruit, and it's just, it does my head in, you know, and these ideas about plants being somehow poisonous to you, and just such incredible misinformation. Look, if you're going to sit there and have a kilo of grapes across the course of the day, that's obviously not going to be a good thing, very high in concentrated sugars. But we should be aiming for our 2 or 3 fruit serves a day, making it as diverse as possible, because the more diverse our plant foods and the more diverse our diet, the more diverse our gut. And it's like a rainforest, you know, it's really diverse. It's much healthier and more resilient. It's linked to better outcomes for cancer, for all sorts of health outcomes. It's all about balance. I mean, we know that having a diet that consists all of fruit is going to be a problem, because then you're not having the other stuff. But 2 or 3 serves a day, I mean, I've got my banana and nuts for afternoon tea. I often have apples, mandarins, whatever fruit, berries, all sorts of things. The more phytonutrients you can get in, the better.
Victoria, I don't know if you had anything additional to add there about that topic of sorting out good advice from misinformation, how you've managed to navigate that, or any resources.
I think I've been duped like everyone else. I think part of it is my own experience with restrictive and extreme sort of dieting and diets. So I think I've really embraced that sort of balance and moderation, just because my experience showed that there was always a negative outcome with others as well. And so I feel like I'm always learning. I'm always learning, and I'm always sort of, the biggest thing that I couple it with, because of my experience previous is to couple it with self-compassion while I'm learning and just adding things and trying things. And if I make a mistake, or I don't even like to call them mistakes, it's just, you know, experience. And and it's interesting that you said early on that about, you know, meats and things. So I just haven't had any interest in eating meats, but it's not because I'm trying to restrict it. I think if I was actually actively stepping away from it, well, I can't say that's completely true, but it's not something where I am really militant about it, about those choices, because as soon as I do, then that's when I get into danger and I usually fail to get the proper nutrients.
And I'm a bit the same. And I think that, you know, a tendency to binge eat and that restricting cycle is, it's very, very common. And it very much varies between individuals. And this is just going back to the question, Emma, about intermittent fasting. Now, the evidence doesn't suggest that it helps with weight loss. There's just been a good trial published that shows that, you know, it's the same as any other weight loss strategy, or another weight loss strategy, at least. Whether or not it's good for the body is, I still think, an open question. Most of the information is coming from animal studies, and we're just not the same as rodents. So we have to be very careful in extrapolating there. But what I find is that if I try to restrict that on those, say, 5 to 2 days a week, it just makes me binge. You know, like I'm restricting all day, and I'm feeling miserable and anxious and irritable. And then at the end of the day, I just go, ah, and then I want to stuff my face. Whereas I know my husband can quite much more happily do that, and it doesn't have that same effect on him. So I think if you know that you're a little bit bingy, stick away from intermittent fasting and just try and concentrate on, you know, every day eating great quality foods in, you know, moderate amounts, just not great big huge ones. That's where I have to really focus and be mindful.
Yes, definitely. Anyone I've known who's doing the 5-2 diet, I ask, you tell me which 2 days you're fasting, and I'll stay right out of your radar. Yeah. On those days.
It's horrible. And there's no good evidence that it's helpful. So, I mean, I think for some people, they find it useful as a weight maintenance or weight loss strategy. But for many others, I think it can promote that binge eating mentality.
Our next question is on that topic of weight again, just asking you to expand on something you brought up a little bit earlier. The questioner asks, it's news to me that body weight should not be the focus. I've always heard that being overweight or obese is highly detrimental to healthy mood regulation. Is there really no truth to that idea?
It's much more complex than that, as in most things in science and the human body. So when we have excess fat or excess weight, particularly around our middle, it can promote inflammation. And inflammation is a problem for everything from depression to cancer to heart disease. So there's no doubt that having a healthy weight being in that healthy weight range is better for our health in general. The problem is it's not achievable for so many people, particularly in our industrialized food environment. And when you make the conversation around food focused on weight, it's counterproductive. It just doesn't help. It makes people feel stigmatized, feel miserable, feel guilty. And it also, you know, as I said, most people find it very challenging to lose weight without bariatric surgery. And which I have to say, I think there are great outcomes for bariatric surgery. And if people are in a position that they need to do that, I think that they shouldn't shy away from thinking about that. But when we look at the research literature, there's no evidence at all that body weight is the way in which diet works to affect our mental health. Even though we know if someone's depressed, probably because of the more that the stress hormones, they'll have more of a tendency to put on weight around their stomach. And then there's some evidence that if people are overweight, it can increase the risk of depression. And again, we think it's because of these, you know, inflammation. But if you tackle inflammation, not by focusing on your body weight, but by focusing on your gut, where 70% of your immune system lives, then you're going to be tackling inflammation at the root cause. And so you're going to be doing yourself all those favors. And what people find often is that they start to focus on the quality of their diet And that gradually means that they feel better. So they start moving more, going for walks, riding a bike. They stop smoking. They start to sleep better. All of these other things change. And all of those things just quite naturally over time can feed into body weight coming back to a level where it's a bit healthier.
Victoria, is there anything you'd like to add to that? It seems like over time you've developed a way to have a much more flexible and compassionate attitude towards nutrition and body image.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that what was a big shift for me was that also one thing that I found is that when I am depressed, I often am eating a lot more, but I'm eating a lot more of, you know, high processed foods, high sugar, refined foods and things. So I'm not getting the kinds of things. And in turn, I would be gaining weight. So instead of actually focusing on losing the weight, it was about even ignoring the sort of refined foods that I was having, but bringing in more of that, foods that were fruits, vegetables, legumes, the sort of the natural non-processed foods. And when I started doing that, it pushed some of the other ones out, surprisingly. Right. It didn't eliminate them. And it was exactly what you were saying, is that then I sort of felt like I wanted to get up, because like I call it the carbohydrate coma. Like if I binge on bread and whatever other kind of high processed stuff, I just want to fall asleep. I seem to have more energy and so I'm more interested and I have a better outlook. And so it makes it easier for me to do some of the wellness tools. Even if I am quite seriously depressed, it doesn't mean that I'm, you know, happy-go-lucky, but it makes it a little easier for me to pick up some of those other wellness tools. Mm.
And I think you touch on a really important point. As I mentioned at the start, these foods are designed to interact with those reward systems of the brain. And when we're sad, when we're stressed, when we're anxious, we reach for things that give us reward, you know, whether it's internet shopping or half a bottle of wine or cigarettes or drugs or junk foods. They give us the short-term hit of pleasure. And then the brain wants more because it feeds those reward systems. But the long-term impact is detrimental. So junk food falls into that same category of short-term gain for long-term pain.
Yeah, and that was interesting. The psychiatrist I was working with was talking about that. And she was saying that, you know, having, you know, let's say binging is one of the things that I would do to cope. And she said, you know, if you're doing that from time to time, that's not the real issue. The real issue is that if that's the only coping tool that you have. And so, and that's what I find, is that it goes back to that sort of, am I being so rigid in what kinds of foods do I need to eat or not eat or things like that? So having that flexibility and it's all about what you said, it's that balance. And there are days where it's easier and other times when it's not. And when that's the case, it's like, okay, it's like, I'm going to go to bed early and wake up tomorrow morning and hopefully it'll feel like a better day.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I've had a long experience, not in the last 20 years or so, but of quite serious anxiety and depression. And that's one of the things that got me into this field and got me interested. And there are days where you just, you just don't do the things that you know you should do. And you do eat too much toast with jam and just want to curl up on the couch. And that's okay, as long as it's not every day, as long as you have a strategy for kind of moving yourself out of it. And sometimes that might be taking yourself out to have a nice, like a Mexican meal, put it this way, Mexican food, yay, it's got beans, it's got plants, it's got a bit of cheese, that's okay. But you don't have to prepare it yourself and you can go and eat it. And you're just starting to get back on track. That's what I find is really helpful for me.
I might be trying to be ambitious here, but I know we've got so many questions and I want to see whether I can squeeze in two more. So I'll ask you to keep your answers to these last ones brief. Yeah. And we'll see if we can follow up with some after the fact. But one's just come in that I think is really interesting. It doesn't make sense to me that the same foods would be recommended for both mania and depression. Are there any specific foods that you'd recommend for one mood episode versus the other?
We just don't have any research evidence at this stage because the field of nutritional psychiatry is pretty young. I mean, it was really 2010 that these first sentinel studies were published. And so most of the research that's been done so far has been on unipolar depression and secondary anxiety. We really want to do research in bipolar disorder, but we haven't had any luck in getting funding for it. And we've tried, believe me. So there's just no research evidence yet to suggest that you might have a different dietary strategy for one state or another. We just don't know. I would imagine that there wouldn't be any particular reason at this stage to think that they might be different. In the future, with more money, more research, we may find out differently.
Okay, great. Yes, the perpetual problem of funding and research. Mm. Victoria, do you have anything to add to that one? Or?
No, I think I'm not even qualified to go near that. So.
Okay.
The only thing that I could say, though, is that I do find if I'm in hypomania or mania, getting heavier foods, this is totally anecdotal, though. So whether it's protein, egg, sort of some kind of, you know, good solid thing, more or less to ground me. And so, and making sure that I eat enough, because oftentimes when I'm in mania or hypomania, I'm not eating at all. So.
Yeah. And I would just say here too, though, that there was a very interesting study in bipolar disorder of probiotics where they showed that compared to placebo, people who are taking probiotics over time had fewer instances of being hospitalized with mania. Now, we at this stage are not recommending supplements because we think you're messing with a very, very complex system. However, I think that we're very interested in fermented foods. Because fermented foods have not only the bacteria, but they have all the fermentation products. They're the things that really do all the things in your body and your brain. So things like kefir and yogurt, unsweetened yogurt and kombucha and all of those sorts of things, you know, fermented veg, kimchi, sauerkraut, all of these we think have potential utility. We don't know yet because we haven't done the research, but I do think it's interesting that the probiotics seem to work to help people to avoid manic episodes.
Thank you. And the last kind of thing I'll ask the panelists to comment on very briefly is somebody's asked, can you recommend each of the panelists your top three ingredients for nutritious foods?
Well, mine is just, you know, vegetables, beans and beans.
Did you say, and Emma, you said what the most nutritious foods?
The top three, either it can be what you find easiest to incorporate into your diet. We've got a lot of people interested in that kind of gradual lifestyle change, which is the tastiest too.
Yeah, I'm hoping that it's healthy, but brown rice has always been something that's been really, really, it's nutty and delicious. And garbanzo beans.
I love it.
And sunflower seeds. Like you can pop, or any kind of nut, like pecan, like treat yourself to a pecan once in a while. Like, have you tried those things? Yeah. They are amazing. And cashews?
Amazing.
Holy cow.
Yeah, cashews are great gut food. They've got all sorts of prebiotics in them. So nuts are fantastic. They're great for weight maintenance as well. They're great for nutrition and protein. And they're the bomb, really, nuts, I think.
Yeah. You can throw them on anything almost, oatmeal to salads and stuff. So
yeah. I love brown rice too. I have it sometimes for breakfast, you know, you can have it sweet. It's fantastic.
Oh, awesome. Fantastic. And at 6 p.m. in Vancouver, really quite appetite inducing tips from the panelists. Thank you both for sharing your perspectives and giving us, I think, a much more rounded perspective on the role of nutrition and body weight and our mental health. I do apologize. It is really hard to cover, I think, what could be an entire PhD in a single hour event. So we are sorry if we didn't get to any of your questions, but we will try to put together some kind of blog or additional resource after the event.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to there's lots of blogs and information on the Food and Mood Centre website too if people want to know more.
Brilliant. Yes,
that's so yeah, go and have a look.
To bring up the slides. So we do have the resources pack, which shared by Bryn in the chat with the Food and Mood Centre, has a great blog and information about all their ongoing studies. There's an online course that, if I understand correctly, Felice, is currently free, which is talking about a lot of these topics in much more detail than we had time to do today. So we do recommend that you check that out. Felice has written two books, Brain Changer, How Diet Can Save Your Health, which delves into this science again in much more detail. And the fantastically named There's a Zoo in My Poo, which talks about the gut microbiome from a really kind of educational and fun perspective. In terms of our CRESPD resources that we'd like to bring to your attention, we've got a new blog from Louise on her experiences of mania, which is a really powerful read. And one of the exciting updates that we have for you is that we are almost ready to start our Polaros app evaluation trial. So this is an app that the team has developed to help people self-monitor and learn how to improve their quality of life. So if you are currently in North America, we really encourage you to sign up and help us advance the science of how digital tools like this can be helpful for people living with bipolar disorder. If you're outside of North America, you can still access some of our tools for quality of life. We have a quality of life tool on the website, and we also have our Bipolar Wellness Center, which talks about nutrition as well as other quality of life areas, physical health, relationships, identity, the whole spectrum. We also have our CRESPD website where you can keep up to date with any new studies or updates from our team. And you can sign up to our newsletter online. Our next talk BD is going to be with Dr. Manuel Sanchez de Camona, and he will be talking with Victoria about the experience of psychosis and bipolar disorder. And this is a really common experience, but it's not often talked about. So we're really excited to be presenting that in September. You can also watch all of our previous talk BD online on YouTube, and you can also submit questions or ideas for future sessions. We also have our webinars uploaded on Spotify if you'd like to listen. If you have time after today's session, please do complete our little evaluation survey. It helps us know what we can do better in future. And we'd like to issue a warm thank you to all of our funders and partners who help make events like this possible. We are so grateful for their support. If you'd like to stay in touch with us, we have our social media channels here, and we'd love to keep hearing from you. So once again, a tremendous thank you to Felice and Victoria for sharing your expertise today.
It was lovely. It was really lovely to talk with you, Victoria, because, you know, I totally endorse everything you're saying and reflect on my own experiences similarly. So it was a lovely opportunity. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there's lots. It's a very rich conversation. Could be lots more.
Thanks so much, everyone. And until next time, stay healthy and well. Talk soon.
Thanks so much.